This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. The crash that happened Monday night at the corner of Ala Moana Boulevard and Kamakei Street was the worst pedestrian fatality incident in recent memory. Three deaths and three serious injuries. A pickup truck crossed three lanes of traffic and plowed into defenseless pedestrians and cyclists standing on a concrete traffic island. Many in the community responded to this tragedy, including the city council and the state legislature. HPR's political reporter Wayne Yoshioka joins us live to talk more about this.
Hey, good morning, Catherine. You know, lawmakers from the Senate and House of Representatives called a news conference yesterday, and they highlighted some bills that pertain to traffic safety and driving under the while intoxicated, and asked the public to help in terms of toughening laws on drunk and impaired driving. Representative Chris Lee led the discussion because one of the victims, 39-year-old Dr. William Travis Lau, was Lee's classmate at Iolani School. This is what Lee said.
It's frustrating,
especially when you know people, and I think we all do, who've been impacted by this. But the bottom line is, I think we are here with a unified message that we want to engage the public to do better. Because as a state, as a community, we can. And the tools that we want to put into place to make this happen will come out of these discussions that we have over the next few months here in the legislature as we pass bills into laws and look at what we can do to prevent this from happening again. And right now, I can speak for myself when I say everything's on the table. These lives are worth it. If it means targeting initial offenders or especially repeat offenders who've had multiple DUIs over and over again, who continue to endanger lives, this doesn't have to be this way. If it means making a change that would either make those people's lives ugly to save others or to do something that just makes sense, there's got to be something we can do. Because the bottom line is, if you get behind the wheel impaired, you know what you're doing, you know what the risk is. If you kill someone, that's not manslaughter, that's murder. And it's up to us to figure out what we can do to stop that from happening before it ever affects families in this state the way that it has this year and in years past.
Well, Representative Lee introduced a bill to prohibit any person convicted of a DUI from purchasing or publicly consuming alcohol for a period of 3 years. Other bills include requiring ignition interlock program compliance for both installation and removal, and they're adding the definition of substance abuse to DUI law and amend the definitions for drug and substance for the purposes of operating a vehicle. So, you know, you can't introduce more bills because that deadline has passed. So they're going to try to hone these bills and try to make them tougher on the repeat offenders.
Who else was in attendance at that news conference yesterday?
Senator Lorraine Inoue was there. She's the Senate chair of transportation. Carl Rhodes, senator. He's also the chair of the Judiciary Committee. And Representative Lee is chair of the Judiciary Committee there. Della Albalati was there. She was the she's the, you know, majority leader. So there were a lot of people there, but I think Chris Lee really honed in and he really emotionally let forth of what, you know, what the community is really feeling about this tragedy.
And what are we hearing from HPD?
Well, HPD has said that, you know, on average, 3,000 to 4,000 DUI arrests each year are made and about 7,000 statewide. In other words, there are more DUI arrests than robberies, stolen vehicles, assault, or any other crime. But where should the lawmakers really focus? You know, this is not just a knee-jerk reaction from the government. What do they really need to do to really impact on this real tragedy? And HPD Captain Ben Moskowitz from the Traffic Division says there are two critical decision points to hone in on.
If we're talking about an impaired driver, it's a choice that was made by that impaired driver to first of all become impaired, whether through medication or drugs or alcohol, and then second of all to decide that they were okay to drive or they were safe to drive. Those choices take place way before the improper lane change or the excessive speed or the distracted, impaired coordination amongst these body functions that cause the cars to go out of control that result in consequences. So it is a sequence of choices, but it occurs all the way back at the beginning, long before I get the call that there's a serious or critical fatal motor vehicle collision. It happens hours before, and we're talking about a person who's making a conscious decision that I'm okay to drive or I'm okay to drink some more alcohol and then drive. There are just too many safe alternatives available.
And that would include the cab, you know, Lyft and all the other ways of transport, even the bus, I guess. But, you know, the legislature is in a policy dilemma because they're going to hear all these traffic bills on Monday. And on Tuesday, they're going to have a big hearing on marijuana, trying to legalize marijuana. So their policy dilemma is, how do you clamp down on impaired driving and also, on the other hand, try to legalize recreational marijuana? So they're in a big dilemma. I feel that marijuana legalization will have to wait another session.
Yeah, I happened to talk to Carol McNamee from Mothers Against Drunk Driving, and I know that's one big thing is, you know, impairment, and not just by alcohol, but other drugs as well.
Yeah, and, you know, the way government works is, you know, they're trying to do something, and they really are trying to, like, remember the Marco Polo fire in 2017? They immediately tried to do something, but then there was a long study that they had to go through. They had to find out which buildings needed it, and really the issue really went away in terms of the public consciousness. But this one, you know, impaired driving, I think all the research is done. I think all the data is there. So they have the political will and the data to back them up to really pass something that's substantial, that, you know, that make a difference.
And we are just coming off a record number of fatalities for last year.
Right. We had 42 people were killed because of drunk or impaired driving in the state in 2017. And a lot of pedestrian deaths also for speeding and everything else. So drugs and alcohol, you know, we can do something this session. And I think maybe the lawmakers are poised to do something.
And we should mention, I think the Big Island was preparing to launch their Vision Zero plan to reduce serious injury and deaths. And as we heard in the headlines, retired Kauai Police Chief Darryl Perry was hit by a car on the Big Island while he was riding his bike. And he's recovering here in a hospital here on Oahu.
Right. And that Vision Zero program, you know, it's a long-term process where you use engineering, use other ways of enforcement, education, and emergency response strategies. So that's a long-range program that, you know, is not going to be implemented tomorrow.
Right. Well, we'll hear more about it. Thanks, Wayne.
Thank you.
That was Wayne Yoshioka. You are listening to The Conversation. This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your Aloha Friday Backyard Quiz. For today's backyard quiz, we're looking at a favorite local food, the deep-fried, sugary, yeast-leavened donut that traditionally is neither whole or filling. And we're talking about the malasada. The humble, delicious treat made its way to our shores when skilled laborers from Madeira and the Azores came to work the plantations in the late 19th century. Traditionally made on Fat Tuesday to use up all the lard and sugar in the house, delicacies were forbidden during Lent. Shaped into little balls, the dough was deep fried in oil and then covered in granulated sugar. In 1952, Frank Leonard Rago founded Leonard's Bakery, introduced his family recipe to the commercial masses. The question for today, what does malasada mean in Portuguese? We will have the answer later in the program. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Wealth Jar, Kaiser Permanente, and PCAT, Pacific Center for Advanced Technology Training.
Among the 43 states that have a publicly funded preschool program, Hawaii ranks last with less than 5% of four-year-olds enrolled. That's according to a 2017 report from the National Institute for Early Education Research. On Wednesday this week, Governor David Ige signed a plan that aims to expand access to public pre-K. HPR's Ryan Finnerty tells us more about the governor's plan for early childhood education.
First and foremost, we must create a universal statewide high-quality public preschool system that will give every child in Hawaii a head start on learning.
In his State of the State address, Governor Ige laid out his goal for a broad expansion of the state's public pre-K program. On Wednesday, he signed a plan that aims to make it a reality.
The plan includes strategies and priorities that both provide inspiration and structure to our efforts over the next several years. The plan sets forth the foundation for a statewide early childhood system that considers our children's overall health and well-being, safety, family partnerships, early care, and learning.
The plan covers more than just publicly funded pre-K, but includes a big expansion of that program.
Currently, within the Executive Office on Early Learning Public Pre-K Program, we have the capacity to serve 520 students.
That's Lauren Moriguchi, head of the Governor's Executive Office on Early Learning. So is 520 a lot? Not when you look at the broader numbers.
There are about 18,500 four-year-olds in Hawaii, and of that number, about 45% of the four-year-old population is in a private setting. 60% of all four-year-olds are attending some type of early childhood setting.
Governor Ige's plan aims to get 90% of Hawaii's four-year-olds enrolled in a pre-K program within 10 years. This will be accomplished by expanding capacity in the public pre-K program to supplement the existing private schools. Reaching that 90% goal means that in 10 years, the state will be providing pre-K for almost 7,000 children. That's going to require building a lot more classrooms.
Currently, we're looking for existing space on DOE campuses because we recognize that it's very costly to add portables onto school campuses. So in order to reduce the cost, we're looking at what's currently available. And we're working in partnership with Department of Education to identify spaces on DOE campuses at this time. We will be continuing to work with them in the future to identify potential spaces where schools may be interested in having a building built on their campus for pre-K or even additional portables placed on their campuses, but we're not there right now.
In his address to lawmakers, Governor Ige said that more than 300 pre-K classrooms would need to be added. How he plans to pay for them was less clear.
This is a long-term goal, but we don't have to wait until we have the funding for all of it. We can start to fill this significant gap in our education system by being smart about how we use existing space.
Wherever the money comes from, adding an extra 7,000 students won't come cheap. Consider the cost of private pre-K, which we just heard is how most kids in Hawaii get their education. Robin Chun is the head of the University of Hawaii's Early Childhood Education Graduate Program.
Preschool, for most parents, is really, really expensive. Sometimes it's more of their monthly income than paying for a kid in college.
So what are parents and taxpayers getting for that investment? Both Chun and Lauren Moriguchi say the benefits can be wide-ranging.
Kids finishing school, not dropping out, less pregnancy, kids going on to college.
What we see from high-quality pre-K programs is an increased average salary over time, more students staying in the system and graduating from high school, lower rates of special education and remedial programs, and lower crime rates.
But simply expanding access to pre-kindergarten education may not guarantee those lingering benefits.
Now what you're seeing in the research is more nuanced question asked. It's not just putting money into expansion, but for who, under what conditions, and what makes for the kind of high quality and continuous investment throughout that birth through 5P period, especially if you look from birth through three, you know, that's a time when the brain is developing. And especially kids who are in more vulnerable situations, poverty, or they're experiencing a lot of toxic stress in their lives, getting the support, not just for the kids, but their families. It actually changes the architecture of how the brain is developing, and has health impacts, too, over the long haul.
Those lessons have come from other states that rushed to expand pre-K access. Lauren Moriguchi says an improperly structured program can actually have a negative effect.
When states have expanded quickly without having the infrastructure in place, including having a well-prepared and well-supported workforce, the quality of those programs decreased significantly. And what that means for young children and families is that they don't receive the type of program that young children should be having access to, which over the long run can be detrimental to young children. When you look at the target population of at-risk and underserved students that we're trying to serve through our programs, these are children and families who may have experienced trauma in their lives. And in putting them in a classroom where the teacher may not have the expertise in early learning or any coursework in early childhood development, what we've seen are programs which just modify a kindergarten curriculum, which is not necessarily developmentally appropriate, because they expect children to be sitting at desks and in chairs all day or for long periods of time. And when that happens, we see high behavior incidents occur where a lot of these teachers have either referred these children for special education, which sends them down the wrong trajectory. There's also been high instances of suspension and expulsion. Nationwide, the rates of suspension and expulsion in public pre-K programs are three times higher than that of K-12. So this is something that we don't want to see happen in our state, which we can learn from other states which have come before us.
Finding those qualified experts may prove a challenge. Hawaii is already experiencing a shortage of public school teachers, particularly in specialty areas like special education. But Governor Ige didn't seem worried.
The phasing in of our public preschools will give us the time to ensure that we have well-qualified preschool teachers to staff these classes.
Hawaii's current public pre-K program already gives preference to at-risk populations like the children of low earners, special education students, and those speaking English as a second language. I'm Ryan Finnerty for The Conversation.
You can find a copy of the Early Childhood Education State Plan posted with this story on hawaiipublicradio.org. We also want to hear about your experiences for paying for pre-K. Call our talkback line and tell us about it. That number, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You're listening to The Conversation. I'm Catherine Cruz.
Aloha, Noe Tanigawa here with an invitation to join us in Hilo on the 8th or Maui on the 9th when HPR presents the best of Aloha Shorts live. You'll experience powerful readings of local literature first performed on the radio program Aloha Shorts. I think you'll enjoy these stories about life in Hawaii told live. So Neighbor Island Ohana, find your seats at hprtickets.org.
Sponsored in part by Hawaiian Airlines.
Honolulu Civil Beat regularly brings us our reality check. And today, reporter Marcel Henre is on the line. He has a column about we have too many cars on the road, right, Marcel?
That's right. Happy Aloha Friday, Catherine.
Yeah, so I know you're on the road a lot on your bicycle.
Yeah, I do both. You know, I both drive and I bike where I can. So I try and get a good mix of perspective on what it's like to commute.
So what did you find out in your research?
Well, I've lived on Oahu now for about 6 years, and it's always been my general perception that particularly in the urbanized areas, we're saturated with cars. Every little nook and cranny is just overflowing with really heavy vehicle use. And so I was really just kind of curious about, you know, what our capacity is and what the trend has been. And what I found is basically in the last 25 years or so, we have seen a 30% spike in registered cars. We've added that equals 190,000 new registered cars on Oahu. And at the same time, the island has seen about a 12% increase in population. So car registration is certainly outpacing the population increase. And also at the same time, another good metric to look at is the total miles driven on the island. And we've also seen about a 30% spike in the last 25 years in the total miles driven. And that equals a 1.6 billion increase, billion miles, I should say, billion with a B on Oahu. So our roads, you know, very long story short, it's not just you. Traffic is getting progressively worse year in and year out, and you know, we're way over capacity.
Yeah, the roads are really crappy too. They don't seem to last as long.
There's that too.
Now I know you and I live in the same general area, and I'm just amazed when I'm on the freeway and I see the Sixth Avenue cutoff backing up and the Cocoa Head cut off. I mean, it's a dangerous situation out there.
Right, right. I mean, I looked at this mainly from a congestion standpoint, simply the headache point of view, but you're right. I mean, this gets to the point where there are safety issues as well. And, you know, one of the questions I really want to pose is at what point does this all become untenable? You know, we can continue. We're actually not at, I guess I should say, we can continue to add cars and we can continue to wait longer. But, you know, all the social costs and the costs in terms of time and away from your family, things that you're describing, you know, at what point do we start to kind of shift our quote-unquote car culture?
Right. And, you know, there are also side issues. We have all those abandoned cars that we're seeing pop up in various neighborhoods. But that's a whole other story.
That is a whole other story. I'm actually at the Capitol right now, and they are looking at legislation. They're looking at other ways that they might be able to deal with the abandoned cars and to get those off the roads more quickly.
So what does DOT say?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I talked to Ed Sniffen, who is the Highways Administrator for DOT, yesterday. And, you know, he's really straightforward. He's like, yeah, we cannot handle the demand that we have today. The only real solution that he sees is to actually change the demand, spread it out or change it altogether. And by that, he means really kind of changing things like work start times, you know, where you stagger it, or where employers and schools, you know, public and private schools, stagger their start times. And you can also let people work and study remotely and at offices that are closer to where they live. DOT is actually implementing that program for its employees. That's more than 1,000 people. So they're actually trying to walk the walk. But that ultimately, we are not going to meet. We just simply aren't going to hit meet the demand that we have right now with the road system that's in place. We need to kind of, you know, shuffle it around, so to speak.
And I know when they tried talking about staggering work hours, there was always the big hurdle, which is dealing with the unions.
Yeah, that's still a work in progress. That came up in our conversation as well. It just seems to be a conversation that just, you know, they just kind of keep kicking it down the road year after year. And it's something that you know, I actually argue in the column that we need to give it a little more urgency.
Right. And I know, you know, what we've seen with the pedestrian fatalities, I know folks are saying, oh, what do we do about this? And lots of proposals coming through the legislature. So we'll see what makes it at the end. Thanks
right,
a lot.
Right.
Thanks a lot, Marcel.
Thanks, Catherine.
That was reporter Marcel Henry with today's reality check. To read his column, visit civilbeat.org.
When the personal computer first debuted, it wasn't just engineers who got excited. Artists adopted the new technology as a partner in their work. I'm John Dankosky on the next Science Friday, how digital art emerged from 20th century innovations and continues to surprise. That's on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
This afternoon from 1 to 3.
Today we take you out and about with a hearty band of volunteers, part of a citizen forestry team. Over the last 2 years, they have mapped some 6,000 trees in Kailua. They are now in Honolulu tackling neighborhoods in Manoa and soon to be in Kaimuki. We caught up with Heather McMillan, who works for the state. She happened to be hard at work on Arbor Day. We talked with her about this state program and how it all got started.
In general, I would say we speak for the trees, but we also speak for communities because we are so interdependent on each other. We obviously rely incredibly on trees to do everything from provide oxygen for us, to cool us with shade, to provide habitat for our pollinators and seed dispersers, for fruit, for materials to make lei, and so many other things. For our well-being in general, but also especially in urban areas, trees rely on us to help take care of them. So we're working on promoting those relationships between people and trees and helping to expand our urban tree canopy and the well-being of our communities, because those things are really the same thing.
So we're here at Foster Gardens, and it's Arbor Day that we're celebrating, and lots of folks here are coming to pick up their free trees to plant.
Our Ka'olunani Urban and Community Forestry Program supports Arbor Day as one of our big events. We do it, it's only possible with a lot of partners, and here at Foster Garden, today the big partner is Smart Trees Pacific, and they've helped to organize and really create an awesome a celebration of the trees. So that's one of the things that our program does. Another is we have a community grants program. So we support the greening of communities statewide through grants. Some are for schools specifically to help cool schools, but really a broad vision of anything from outreach, education, tree planting, and greening of our communities to support good work that's already going on. We have a citizen foresters program, and that is something that is volunteer driven. They have been very active in Kailua and have helped to inventory all of the street trees there, finished that this last few months ago. They're also active in Manoa, Waikiki area, working to help to inventory these important resources for our city so we can know where they are, what they are, the status of them, so they can be better cared for as well.
So walk us through. I mean, what happens on a typical day when you've got volunteers from the community coming out for this?
Typically, there are groups that meet weekdays in the afternoons and evenings, and some groups, the one that I participated in, I went through the program too. I'm a certified citizen forester as well, goes out on Saturday mornings. We have our clipboards, we have our devices, iPhones, Androids, or tablets to be able to find out, to plot where the trees are, to identify what kind of tree it is, and also if there are any issues with the tree, if it needs any help, or even if there are manuoku, or the native white terns nesting there. Those are things that we would want to know as well. So just helping us better understand what our resources are so we can better care for them. So we go around in small groups, we measure their height, we measure their canopy, we measure their girth. We talk to them. They talk to us. Yeah. And it's also important to inventory where there are opportunities to plant more trees. So that's sort of the next phase for what the very ambitious, passionate group of citizen foresters in Kailua is doing. Now that they've inventoried all the existing trees, they have a phase two of the project where they've identified places where trees could be planted in the city, on city property, and then working with homeowners in proximity to help recruit interest, or some people are very happy to have a tree planted right next to their home. So to work with them and involve them in caring for the tree and its young and vulnerable, you know, first stage of life.
And you folks also identify trees that might be a hazard, let's say with lines, power lines and that kind of thing.
That is something that we note in our inventory as well, if there are conflicts with power lines, yes.
It does sound, though, pretty daunting when you say, oh, we're mapping the trees of Honolulu or Kailua. It's a big job.
It is a big job, but, you know, one neighborhood at a time, and the whole way it's possible. This is a totally citizen-driven program. I mean, these are communities that are inventorying trees in their own neighborhoods. So they see their neighbors. That's what really cool thing that often happens with around trees. It's sort of, it is about planting the tree. It is about inventorying the tree, but it's kind of a gateway to engaging communities and to engaging more broadly, you know, with your neighbors, engaging in other issues that might be important to your family or your community as well. We have plans to expand into more areas in the city. Right now, there is an opportunity through the Kupu program. They're recruiting citizen forester interns. So for folks that are interested, please go to Kupu's website and find out about this opportunity. There are two entry-level positions and one supervisor for citizen foresters that to help advance this program and kind of take it to a new level too. So there's a variety of ways to get involved. And it's great training. You know, you do learn about how to identify the trees, how to understand their health. We offer ongoing outreach and education for the citizen foresters as well. For example, there's plans now to do a rapid ohia death training. We don't have to deal with this right now on Oahu, but we want to be aware. It's an important issue, especially on Hawaii Island, and we know it's also been identified on Kauai. So rapid ohia death, the coconut rhinoceros beetle, just other things to be aware of, to take stock of, so we can better take care of our urban forest.
What about the plans to expand this citizen forestry program on the neighbor island?
Great question. In fact, our Ka'ulunani Urban and Community Forestry Advisory Council is having their quarterly meeting on Kauai this time, and we will also be having an outreach event to spread the word on citizen foresters. There's some interest there, spearheaded by one of our council members to bring that program to Kauai, so we're super excited about that. We've had others ask from Maui as well, and we do want to spread it to all the islands. So we're gearing up and building our capacity and thinking about training the trainers so that folks are empowered to do the training themselves too. Okay. With their communities.
So you've planted the seed here.
Yes.
and want it to grow.
Absolutely, absolutely.
All right, well, thank you for talking with us.
Oh, thank you so much for the chance. Happy Arbor Day.
And that was Heather McMillan, who's with the Department of Land and Natural Resources. And in the weeks following that interview, we caught up with a team of citizen foresters mapping trees in Manoa Valley. Here's Shannon Rivera, Smart Trees Pacific Coordinator.
When we start meeting up, we sign in, we see what has been done in the area. It's great that Tom has a map because it actually kind of shows you visually what's already been done, what needs to be done, where exactly you are. And then we go out, we break into groups of three or four, and we go out and get the trees done. So you can see on the map where the trees are that we need to get done. And then we have all of the equipment. We have the hypsometer, we have diameter tape, we have 100-yard tape. And those are all tools that help us figure out the conditions of the trees. So height, diameter, canopy cover, all that information, and then condition of the tree. So we also get species and then how it's doing, which street trees a lot of times aren't doing as great as private trees. And you have to learn how to kind of assess that, but you get better with that with time and with expertise and having people on board like Tom and Eileen and Betty, who go out almost every week. Hartson's here every week. And I'm sure over this past year that they've been doing this in this area, you start to kind of get to know the trees a little bit better. But yeah, so we're gonna break into two groups since we have enough people. And we'll have one person mapping online, so you using our tree plotter system to plug in those GPS points to show where the tree is. We have one person recording, so writing down all the details, and then a few people kind of running around scrambling, getting the data we need to put it on the sheet. And then later, Tom will take this data, go back into the tree plotter system, and enter it all in, and that's when we get the results of that tree. So later it'll show up and it'll pop up all of the benefits of the tree. So all the carbon it's sequestered, all of the carbon that it's storing, the runoff it's preventing, gosh, every eco benefit that we can get from the data that we collect will be shown on our system. So that's a really cool tool that the city uses.
That was Shannon Rivera. She was out with a volunteer group that was mapping trees in Manoa. The group's currently working in a couple of areas in Honolulu. For links to find out how to volunteer, check our website at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programs. Mahalo to contributors Ekahi Health, Ulupono Initiative, and Impact Hub Honolulu Co-Working.
Earlier today, we explored the history of the delicious local pastry, the malasada. It was introduced when skilled laborers from Madeira and the Azores came to work on sugar plantations in the late 19th century. The yeast 11 donut was traditionally made on Fat or Shrove Tuesday to use up lard and sugar forbidden during Lent. One of the most famous places to find malasada is Leonard's Bakery on Oahu. As the story goes, shortly after the storefront opened in 1957, founder Frank Leonard Rego's mother suggested making the pastry for Shrove Tuesday. He listened to his mom, and the rest is Hawaii food history. Nowadays, you can still spot a line of people waiting for orders of traditional sugar malasadas or the newer versions filled with custard or haupia pudding. You can find them at carnivals or bakeries statewide. Did you know that despite its classification as a fried food, malasada means undercooked in Portuguese? That was the answer we were looking for, and Andrew from Kailua got that right. For today's quiz, that was the answer for today's quiz, and if you have an idea for one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. The course of true love never did run smooth, whether it's Elizabethan England or within the caste system of India. Bollywood takes to the stage at the University of Hawaii's Kennedy Theater with A Midsummer Night's Bollywood Dream. Take a listen. Associate Professor Sai Barodaktar chatted with us about the upcoming production, which opens tonight at Kennedy Theater.
It was an interesting process. So the theater department has many aspects to it. There's a Western theater program, there's a Asian theater program, there's a dance program, and so on. And the theater faculty was actually trying to come up with ways in which we could combine all these programs together. So South Asia was on the table, as it were, and I had suggested South Asian playwrights and other plays that I was working on separately. But then a Shakespeare production was also on the table. So it kind of gave us an opportunity to bring together Western theater, Asian theater, dance programs.
So how long did this process take?
Oh, it took a long time. We started, really brainstorming it back in 2017, and then a lot of the music work, for example, and a lot of conceptual work we did last year, starting in the spring semester, so starting, February, about a year ago.
Right, so finally it's going to come on stage.
Yeah, it's going to come on stage on February 1st.
How exciting, though, to pair up Shakespeare with Bollywood. What a novel idea.
It's actually very interesting. We are sort of placing ourselves in a tradition, but at the same time being very unique. Indian cinema, not just Bollywood, but Indian cinema has a long tradition of adapting Shakespeare. So recently we have had a brilliant director, Vishal Bharadwaj, has done a trilogy of Maqbool, which is based on Macbeth, Othello, Omkara, and Haider, Hamlet. And then there's sort of art productions. There have been popular productions of Romeo and Juliet, for example, that are, song and dance extravaganzas in the Bollywood style. So Indian cinema has a tradition of fusing or adapting Shakespeare. And what we are trying to do is very unique and educational, actually, because it is important for the co-director Paul Mitri, who's a Shakespearean expert, to teach his students how to say Shakespeare's lines, how to understand his text, how to deliver it, and so on. So we're keeping Shakespeare's text, but weaving all these Bollywood aspects in it, where I wrote songs in Hindi that set up the stage, that translate Shakespeare's content line by line, which then rhyme in Hindi, and the last line in Hindi rhymes with his English line, and so on. So it's like a bilingual poetry writing that I did a lot for this production,
wow,
which was then set to music by Ike Webster.
Right, but so it's pretty deep, pretty involved.
Oh, yeah, my God. There's an enormous amount of conceptual and literary and creative work that has gone into it, yes.
So your part in this production, you know, you help choreograph, you help with the music. We have a snippet of part of that production. Let's take a listen.
This is a magical lullaby, actually. So the fairy queen, which in Shakespeare's text is Titania, and we made it her into Tarana. Tarana means tune or music, actually, in Hindi. So these are the fairies that are around her, who we have choreographed as her badass bodyguards rather than, you know, extras dancing in the background. And this was one of the examples that I gave you about poetry writing. So I wrote the spell. What you heard is the spell of the fairies trying to protect her and dispelling vile things in the forest away from her so that she's protected. So I took Shakespeare's content, but I created a spell in Hindi that actually takes from the elements of spell writing in Hindi itself, in the Hindi literature. But then the last line of ek do teen rhymes with fairy queen. So then we can go from Hindi to English and then create the rest of the song in English. And this was a beautiful music writing experience because this song is sung by the cast members. So all of us, you know, wrote it together and Ike Webster gave this amazing sort of dreamy, magical feel to it. And then choreographing it was a lot of fun, too, because we created protective walls around the fairy queen. We took bows and arrows and dispelled vile things in the forest and then created these lotus formations around her. Yeah,
it sounds exquisite.
It was beautiful.
Now, I had the opportunity to attend the opening of the Bollywood Festival at the Doris Duke Theater at the Honolulu Academy, and you were there dancing.
Yes. I teach dance. I teach Bollywood dance at UH Manoa, and I've also created a community dance group, which is completely free of charge. I welcome anybody who wants to learn Bollywood dance on Sundays at Kennedy Theater, and we just, you know, claim public spaces for public joy and learning. We have been doing workshops and dancing for the Honolulu Museum of Art for a long time. And the opening workshop that you saw, one of the people who did a solo, she's also in the cast of Midsummer Night's Bollywood Dream. So she's actually the Indian-American person who opens the play. It's set in her dream. So the whole entire place is her dream, is Sia's dream.
It really does sound very dreamy. I mean, it's the elements that you've got, and it just sounds so deep.
Yeah, there's a lot of sort of very cross-cultural, meticulous and meta thinking that went into it. My particular research is also actually cross-cultural philosophy and film adaptations of literature. So that's been my master's degree and my PhD is in cross-cultural philosophy. So I'm very aware of all the, you know, all the elements of how different cultures come together, what kind of relationships and fusion and creative appreciation, but also interesting questions of identity and identity flows and global flows in which we place ourselves.
You must have had just a ball putting this together.
Yeah, it was a lot of hard work and tremendous amount of energy from the entire crew. I couldn't have asked for a better crew.
And so tell me about the costuming.
Oh, Miley has done our costuming. She's actually a genius. She's a genius. One of the prominent features that you'll see are beautiful twirling skirts that we gave to the fairies. And the fairies, the concept of fairies is that they are cosmically big and tiny at the same time. So they represent the stars as well as fireflies. So you have this amazing lit, brightly lit and twirly aspect to the fairies. We have different costumes for the wedding guests, of course, from what you see, from kurta pajamas to ghagra, cholis to saris and so on.
And so did you have a hard time at all getting the saris and all the costume elements together?
Miley would probably say yes, all logistically, but I think they built a lot of costumes and then bought ready-made costumes that they fit with every person, every person's body and so on.
I was just able to catch a art exhibit in Seattle. It was the Maharaja, and it was very similar to the Kalakaua exhibit, but just with the Indian monarchy. And it was fabulous to see, some of the outfits and the mobile palace,
right,
and to see the scale.
Right.
But just it's a visual feast, the elements of the Indian culture. It's fabulous.
Right, absolutely. And we're also very aware of the fact that we're sort of creating this space that is in a dreamy cloud, that is in, an Indian-American cast member's dream, basically. So instead of specifically locating it in a particular village or town in India, we're setting it in a genre, right? We're setting it in that's the meta level of looking at the play, or we're setting as one of the other cast members, Kripa, who's also an Indian American. In a conversation, it came up that she said she's Indian-American, and she takes the hyphen very seriously. So in some ways, we're doing this balancing act on the hyphen between Indian and American.
That was Sai Bakhtargar talking about the Indian adaptation of A Midsummer Night's Dream. It opens tonight and runs 2 weekends through February 10th. That is it for this week. Coming up next week, we look at the efforts to keep the historic ship Falls of Clyde afloat. It just turned 140 years old. Can it avoid the scrap heap? What do you think should be done? Call our talkback line and leave us your comments. Here's that number, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post your comments on Facebook at The Conversation or tweet us at HI Conversation. You can also find us on Instagram at The Conversation HPR. Our program is produced by Lillian Song, Ryan Finnerty, and Amber Congrusby. The Backyard Quiz theme written for us by John DeMello. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us on Monday and pick up The Conversation.